Welcome back. So for this session, we're going to be talking about the turn in poetry, and the turn as a form of argument and surprise. So to quote Marvin Bell and his 32 statements about writing poetry, a poem listens to itself as it goes. And I like to think about this in relationship to the turn, because I feel that the turn is, in a way, an example of the poem listening to itself and responding to itself, saying no, or but, or suddenly, or and then. And I think that's, you know, a really nice way of thinking about that practice. And so,
and in this turn, we'll begin with Forrest Gander, a poet, translator, essayist, and editor of several anthologies of writing from Spain and Mexico. His 2011 poetry collection, Core Samples from the World, was a finalist for both the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award. He's received fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Guggenheim, Howard, and Whiting Foundations, and he's received two Gertrude Stein Awards for innovative poetry. And he will be followed by Dora Malik, the author of Shore-Ordered Ocean and Say So. She has received writing fellowships from Yale, the Iowa Writers' Workshop, and the 2010 Ruth Lilly Poetry Fellowship from the Poetry Foundation. She teaches now at Johns Hopkins University. Onward.
Hi, I'm Forrest Gander. I was asked to talk a little bit about the turn. And the first thing I think of when I think of the turn in poetry is the sonnet and the classical Petrarchan or Shakespearean sonnet, which often has an argument implied in it and develops that argument and then comes to maybe through the eighth line and then turns the argument in a different direction. And there's a wonderful Shakespeare sonnet that we can hear Shakespeare projecting an imagination of what if this could happen, then, and then the poem slides into two strong buts that set up the opposing argument, the limiting argument that defeats all that what if that he was imagining, which is about being with his lover despite the distance that is between them. So you'll hear it in this poem, and you might pay attention to the line breaks also, because I'll talk about them afterwards. So this is Shakespeare, and we're listening for the turn around right after the eighth line. If the dull substance of my flesh were thought, injurious distance should not stop my way, for then, despite of space, I would be brought from regions, limits far remote where thou dost stay. No matter then, although my foot did stand upon the furthest earth removed from thee, for nimble thought can leap, can jump both sea and land, as soon as think the place where he might be. But, thought kills me that I am not thought, to leap large lengths of miles when thou art gone. But so much of earth and water wrought, I must attend time's leisure with my moan, receiving not from elements so slow, but heavy tears, badges of either's woe. So we see the imagination and then the sad realization that his thought isn't time and can't do that, and so he's left to be weary about missing his the person that he loves. And you hear in that kind of a poem, which is a kind of argument, the way that the logic works with the construction of the lines, so that often the syntax and the end of the line, the sort of natural ending to a syntactical phrase, meets the end of the line. So there's a real stable platform of line. If the dull substance of my flesh were thought, that's natural, that's where the line ends, natural syntax ending. If the dull substance of my flesh were thought, injurious distance would not stop my way, period. That's a good kind of poem for meditation, for logical, sort of logical developments of arguments, which were typical of a lot of the early sonnets. A different kind of turn happens, not as an argument in a poem, but at that line end. That, of course, is a turn in what distinguishes lyric poetry from prose. Prose line, the syntax, the line simply goes to the end of the margin, and the break is arbitrary, but poets get to break their line to make it turn anywhere they want. And so that's another kind of turn that can be very important to a poem. And if we think about a poem like the one I'll bring up right now by Marianne Moore, called No Swan So Fine, what we find is a very, because of the way that she breaks her line so very differently than Shakespeare, she breaks it where the syntax doesn't naturally pause, and so that's an enjambment. It creates a very kind of hectic end of the line. We're sort of waiting to find out what fills out the missing part. It's like being sucked into the next part of the line by our curiosity about where the syntax is going to go, because it's open, it's broken, it's enjambed, we would say. And so this is such an interesting poem because, in a way, it's very much about mortality. She's going to mention lots of dead things, and she's going to mention lots of objects. And if she'd constructed it, as Shakespeare constructed his sonnet, so that the syntax, the natural break in the syntax, ended where the line did, then it would be a much more meditative poem than it turns out to be. And what she does is animate the poem and give it a restless energy that really vivifies the subject and has to do with the subject. So her poem goes, which is called No Swan So Fine. No waters so still as the dead fountains of Versailles, no swan with swart, blind look askance and gondoliering leg so fine as the chintz china one with fawn brown eyes and tooth gold collar on to show whose bird it was. Lodged in the Louis XV candelabrum tree of coxcomb tinted buttons, dahlias, sea urchins, and everlastings, it perches on the branching foam of polished marble flowers, at ease and tall. The king is dead. So we have a dead king, we have dead fountains, we have this China swan that never lived. And in some ways, the poem, we could talk about the poem like we talk about Shelley's Ozymandias, that it, in one way of thinking about it, is that people with power and money memorialize their lives or their egos with things that will last maybe forever, like this lasts even though the king is dead. But it's curious, rather than presenting an argument, Marianne Moore is more interested in considering the tension between really the fineness. She says, there is no swan as fine as this chintz china one. This fake swan is even more splendid than perhaps the original one with its gondoliering legs and its blind look askance. And then, of course, her own poem is memorializing itself in art, the memorialized swan, which is a memorial of the live swan, which wasn't so cool as the memorial anyway. And the ending, so we get these long lines that are broken with all this energy. We're sort of falling through the poem like a pachinko ball. And it's, in fact, it's we're hearing this ch-ch-ch-ch-ch throughout the poem. And those broken line breaks give it an energy that it wouldn't otherwise have, that maybe we wouldn't be held through all the naming, all the objects of that that come up in the poem, were it not for the line breaks and the unevenness and the expectation for those to be fulfilled that make us turn the corner of the line and come back to see where it's fulfilled. There's only four periods in the poem, and two of them happen at the end of the last line, at the last half of the last line. And we get these two little I ams, at ease and tall, the king is dead. Bum bum, bum bum, bum bum, bum bum. Sort of like a heartbeat in a way also, which is interesting thinking about all the death in the poem, that in some way, what she does to vivify this description, to make it come alive, to make it feel so animate with the turn of her line break, is to give life to something that's dead, which of course is what Yeats is writing about in Sailing to Byzantium also. There's another kind of turn that I love that happens in a poem that can be a kind of conflation of a perceptual and a conceptual turn. And one example of it happens in a beautiful poem by George Oppen called Psalm. So Oppen's poem is so simple that I heard once a Harvard professor after someone read this poem at a meeting say, well, that's just a romantic poem. But it's not at all. It's very mysterious. And the mystery is in how it turns at the end, on how it turns perception inside out and how it turns, how the poem can be conceived inside out. Oppen's poem begins with part of a fragment of a quotation from Augustine, which is which is veritas sequitur. The rest of it that he doesn't put is esse rerum. So truth follows it's been translated the being or the essence of things. The poem is called Psalm. I also love this poem because the person that turned me on to George Oppen was an editor named Michael Cudahy, who was one of the last Americans to get polio. He got it when he was volunteering at a boys' camp. And while he was in an iron lung, unable to breathe, he taught himself to breathe with his neck muscles, and he was able to live apart from most machines, though he couldn't sleep, of course, on a regular bed. He had a bed that rocked back and forth, which would lower and raise his diaphragm. And all of the breaths that he took during his conscious life were efforts. And I I worked for him for a couple years, in a couple summers, in California, where he would spend his summers. And obviously a man with tremendous limitations on what he could do. Well, one of the things that he loved to do in the evening at twilight was to have me drive him through the California woods looking for deer, and we'd do deer counts. And so I can't but think of him who turned me on to Oppen. He loved Oppen. And in fact, he started the magazine that he ran, which was called Ironwood, which was a very important magazine, particularly in the 80s, by inviting Oppen to submit a poem. Oppen was his hero, and Oppen sent him a poem, and Michael Cudahy had the audacity to send it back and say it wasn't one of his good poems. And Oppen, according to Michael Cudahy, sent back a couple really good poems with the note, "Ah, a serious editor." And Michael was really pleased with that. Here's Oppen's poem called Psalm, Veritas Sequitur. In the small beauty of the forest, the wild deer bedding down, that they are there, their eyes effortless, the soft lips nuzzle, and the alien small teeth tear at the grass. The roots of it dangle from their mouths, scattering earth in the strange woods. They who are there, their paths nibbled through the fields, the leaves that shade them hang in the distances of sun. The small nouns crying, faith in this in which the wild deer startle and stare out. So Oppen loved prepositions, and all through the poem we hear this in. I think there are seven different ins. In the small beauty of the forest. And each one is like a turning the camera lens so that we're coming closer, we're looking towards these deer and coming closer to them. And there's also there. Both kinds of there. The there that's pointing somewhere else is often followed by the possessive there, which emphasizes that otherness, that over-there-ness. So it'll be there. Let's see, it begins, in the small beauty of the forest, the wild deer bedding down, that they are there, their eyes effortless. That happens a couple times. So both the in and the there are creating this relationship of scene where we are approaching inward towards this other place where the deer are. But at the end, there's this completely strange thing that happens right when we get up to them. And the poem shifts from talking about the deer and suddenly begins to talk about something else. He says, he goes from the distances of sun, the leaves, the path that they've been on, to suddenly the small nouns crying faith in this in which the wild, in this in which the deer startle and stare out. So it's in, and then the last word is out, and it's us looking in, and suddenly at the end, it's the deer looking out at us. There's been this complete reversal of the perceptual scenario, which is just miraculous. And also there's been this conceptual reversal, this turn from talking about deer to talking about how we can talk about deer, which is with words, that miracle, that there's a possibility of putting what we feel and what we perceive into words, that we can have faith that words will offer our experience up to someone else. And that magical moment at the end of the poem is a moment of empathy and a moment of hopefulness about what poetry might be able to do in bringing people into contact with one another, because it's what we have, because it's what we hope we have. We have faith that these small words can make other people feel something. So that's another kind of turn, a conceptual, perceptual turn in an Appen poem that I like very much. So turning back on the turns that we've made, we started with the argumental turn that we see happen in a sonnet, for instance, and we've looked at the turn of the line at the end, at the line break, and how activating that can change how a poem feels and how it works and what it's doing. And we did that with the Marianne Moore poem. And in the Appen poem, which combines really both the line break turns and the conceptual turns of Shakespeare with something else, this perceptual turn. We've seen three different ways that turning happens in a poem, which it's now your turn to write.
Hi, my name is Dora Malik. I am a poet and a teacher. I'm the author of two collections of poems, Say So and Short Ordered Ocean. And I'm going to speak today about an element of writing poetry, the craft of poetry writing, that I hope will give you permission to head in unexpected directions in your own work. Give me your word. Your word is your bond. Be a man of your word. The idea of the word in our culture has come to be synonymous with the idea of making a promise, signing a contract, agreeing to move forward in a way that someone else expects you to do. So this idea of the word as a promise, stand-in for faith and constancy and contract and agreement, can carry over into how we approach our own writing. This sense of, I should know what I'm writing about. Even the way that we talk in a classroom about writing, there's often this sense of, what does this poem mean? What is this poem about? And I think that urge to be as dutiful and faithful in our poems as we aspire to be in our lives can paradoxically get us into trouble. Robert Frost says, no tears for the writer, no tears for the reader. No surprise for the writer, no surprise for the reader. So our urge to be a good person and do the right thing and know what we're talking about, be some kind of authority in our writing, can often stand in the way of discovery. And so often if we go to the poems that we love, the poems that we value, the poems that excite us, and that become touchstones for us in our own lives, we find that there is an element of inconstancy, of change, of going back on one's words. And that is, in a way, the kind of hallmark of a writer like Shakespeare, who, if you look at his poems, his sonnets are full of what a rhetoric teacher would call coordinating conjunctions. and that I like to call hinge words, words where you watch a mind change. Or, but, though, if, those words that turn us around and go back on themselves. So we watch a mind at work, we watch a mind wrestling with, as opposed to giving us a clear stance, wrestling with an issue, a question, an emotion, a state of mind. And in your own poetry, you can enact those same turns. I think a good poem to start by looking at is a poem by John Donne called Woman's Constancy, perhaps because it explicitly deals with this idea of a changing mind. And if you look at it, it's essentially talking to a lover and saying, you know, you feel this way, but will you feel that way? Will you feel that way? And then it concludes with this idea of, you know what, I may change my mind too. And it takes what is a negative thing in our own lives, which is inconstancy, and turns it into something beautiful by virtue of the poem. Now thou hast loved me one whole day. Tomorrow when thou leav'st, what will thou say? Will thou then antedate some new made vow, or say that now we are not those persons which we were, or that oaths made in reverential fear of love and his wrath any may forswear? So that's the beginning, and you look down through the poem and you see or, you see so, you see or, you see question marks. And then at the end, essentially Donne says, I could dispute and conquer against this if I would, which I abstain to do, for by tomorrow I may think so too. So that prerogative to change one's mind creates these beautiful motions of this poem. So in our myths, that idea of inconstancy is so often negative. Orpheus turns around and he's punished. Lot's wife looks back and she's punished. And so poetry becomes this place where we can go to dignify and find beauty in the ways in which we can't keep our word, the ways in which we are unfaithful, and that's part of the human condition on some level. So these turns, these changes of mind can be enacted both through the sense of rhetoric, those hinges, or, but, if. So literally, changing one's mind. They can also be enacted by a breaking of what John Hollander calls the metrical contract. So if you set up a poem, whether it's a question of quote-unquote free verse, and you have the line, and then you subvert that line, you break that line and change that expectation, or whether you're writing in a more traditional meter, and you subvert that metrical contract. So, for example, in a poem like Sailing to Byzantium, where the poem can't hold its meter, can't stay true to that metrical contract that was begun, which is, in this case, iambic pentameter, it starts, that is no country for old men, the young in one another's arms, birds in the trees, those dying generations at their song. So you can hear, yes, there's the human utterance. You wouldn't really read, that is no country for old men, the young. You would read as a human would, not as a mathematical robot would. But you feel that underlying beat of the metrical contract. So when there is what's sometimes called an expressive substitution, a place where the meter can't hold firm, it does something to us emotionally, and it's a strength, not a weakness. He's talking about aging. He's saying, this is what happens, this is where you go. And talking about the ability of the soul or the poem to overcome that, he writes, an aged man, and this is Yeats, an aged man is but a paltry thing, a tattered coat upon a stick, unless soul clap its hands and sing and louder sing. So you have this sense of the soul clapping its hands, leaping up, breaking through that that metrical contract of iambic pentameter with that spondi, that two-beat stress at the beginning. An aged man is but a paltry thing, a tattered coat upon a stick, unless. So we have this sense of this is how your life proceeds, unless you jump in, unless you change something, unless you let your soul have its say. soul clap its hands and sing, and louder sing, for every tatter in its mortal dress. So we have this sense of rhetorical change, rhetorical inconstancy, metrical change, metrical inconstancy. And then the very nature of the metaphor is a kind of inconstancy, a kind of surprise, a kind of subversion of what we know to be the truth. You have a poem like André Breton's Free Union, or L'Union Libre, which is a common law marriage, but it's also this paradox of free union. You're bound and yet you're free. And he takes all these different images of a wife. My wife whose hair is a brush fire, whose thoughts are summer lightning, whose waist is an hourglass, whose waist is the waist of an otter caught in the teeth of a tiger. And it moves forward like that, line upon line, where the wife changes, she shapeshifts. There's this inconstancy that discovers a different kind of truth from the truth of the faithful, the constant, the dutiful, the bond. And these are all changes, inconstancies, leaps of faith, lacks of faith that you can take in your own poems. In a poem by Yusuf Komunyaka, there are these images of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. And so he says, a white vet's image floats closer to me than his pale eyes look through mine. I'm a window. He's lost his right arm inside the stone. In the black mirror, a woman's trying to erase names. No, she's brushing a boy's hair. And you would think in the process of revision, you should say, no, decide which it is. Do you want to say she's trying to erase names, or do you want to say she's brushing a boy's hair? Which is the truth of the situation? And in a poem, we not only can inhabit multiple truths at once, it's beautiful to inhabit multiple truths at once. It's a strength to inhabit multiple truths. You can return to Keats's idea of negative capability, which he calls, when a man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. And so in a world in which fact and reason are valued, in which politicians are called flip-floppers if they change their mind, in which our word is our bond, we're supposed to be men and women of our words, poetry is a place where we can go to find the thrilling plurality of our words, in which we can be men and women of all of our words. So I would say, well, in our daily life, we try and often fail to stand by our word, to be faithful, to be men and women of our bond, to be dutiful, to do the right thing. Poetry gives us space to inhabit many words, to explore the human condition and our own lives and sensibilities without judgment of ourselves or others. So I would encourage you to give me, your reader, not only your word singular, but the thrilling plurality of your words, your negative capability. In a poem, you can look forward and look back. You can show the reader that they're not alone in their stumbling, in their stuttering, in their confusion, in their uncertainty. So in your poems, go back on your words and go forth on your words, and happy writing. Thanks for listening.
We hope you enjoyed those videos. Remember that poetry verse implies a turn. It's when the plow gets to the end of the field, it turns. And that turn is integral to the meaning making of a poem. There comes a moment when you're writing, it seems to me, that things are going along in one direction and then something else happens. The floor, the bottom of the floor drops out, and that's the place where it gets interesting. Is that your experience?
I definitely agree. I think that that's one of the things that makes writing poems exciting and reading poems exciting, is that you don't really want to know where you're going to end up. You don't want to feel that the destination is predetermined. And, you know, it's great to be reading a poem and then you end up in a place that you didn't expect at all. I think that's one of the exciting things about it.
It makes me think of that line by the Russian Nobel laureate Joseph Brodsky, who said that what the experience of writing prose is that with each page you gain confidence, but with each line of verse, you find yourself in new terrain.
Yes,
that make you feel anxious, but it also makes you alert.
And yes, it makes you alive.
Yeah,
definitely. So, on that note, remember to log on and get your assignment. Join the discussion forums, post your poems, and respond to each other's work.
Onward.